I've known Mike for a long time, and I have seen him go through some trials and tribulations in his recovery, and he's done it. I mean, he just worked the program, he did the things he was supposed to do, and he got through all those different things that have happened, both the positive and the negative. So because I've known him for such a long time, I felt that his story tonight would be able to benefit everyone in the room tonight. So anyway, I give you Mike K.
I am standing. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 12th, 1989. And I don't know if that has an effect on you or if you even believe me, but it blows my mind. I didn't think that was possible. I always bring this with me, not that I tell my story very often. This is the original big book I was given. It's a third edition, you know, different page numbers. But what's unique about it is on most of the pages, there's many, many well wishes from the other inmates that were in there with me. As far as I know, there might be one other left standing. That's it. This disease kills. Oh, let's see. Should start at the beginning. I'm the oldest of three. I was raised in a Christian home. But there was one time I was at church and I heard the pastor say, thinking it's as bad as doing it. And I go, oh, shit. This is over, you know. It's going to be like this the rest of my life. Anyway, I was really a late bloomer. I didn't have any of that golden liquid or any of the other what we call outside interests in AA until I was 19. So, but don't worry. They say my spiritual development ceased as soon as I started drinking alcohol. I can't say 19, I wish I could, but what about that little bit of beer in a glass that my dad gave me at night to put me to sleep because I was such a hyper little shit, you know? So it started young. It started young. Enough. Went through college and that, and I can't say my dad was an alcoholic, but he might have been a rageaholic. And being the eldest, I got the discipline for all three of us kids. Of course, I've come to believe that he was just doing the best he could the way he was raised. But I was a music major, and he pushed me into that, and he'd always have me get and say, get up there on the keyboard. And, you know, he was living vicariously through me. My brother and sister also played, took lessons for a while. They were able to give it up. I couldn't. I had to major in it in college. As I said, I didn't start drinking until I was 19. And that was in the early college years. And back then, you know, streaking was, do you guys know what streaking is? I just wondered, you know, you got some young people in here. I'm talking a different language, I know it. You know, in your college years, that's something you did. But when you're in your 30s, they don't laugh at it as much, you know? So, as a result of my behavior, I got this new collection of friends, the kind with badges, long black robes, gavels, that kind of thing. And one of the guys actually had the audacity to sentence me to lifetime psychiatric counseling, like I had a problem. So I started seeing the shrink, and her name was Ava. And, you know, I did what any good alcoholic did. I lied to the shrink. You know, that's what we're supposed to do, isn't it? And things kept getting worse, of course. And if you have, I was on the left coast. I forgot to mention that when this all this happened. That's California for you guys that are new. And my ex-wife asked me one morning, she said, "Do you remember last night?" And I got a real chill. It scared me because I didn't remember. She said, "You got up, you went to the restroom, and you came, and we had windows on either side of the bedroom." She said, "You walked from one side of the bedroom to the other, looking out the back, in the backyard, and arguing with me that I was on the wrong side of the bed." Now, that doesn't sound like a lot to you, I'm sure, but that 1 hour drive to work the next morning, didn't matter what kind of music I put on the radio, it just sounded like white noise. And after about an hour at work, I grabbed the phone and I called Ava and I said, "I need help." And she said, "I've never been more proud of you than I am right now." And she asked if she should make the phone call. I said, "No, I'll make the phone call." I made an appointment with the EAP, Employees Assistance Person at Work, and went in and talked to him, and he asked me, "What kind of insurance do you have?" And I told him, and he said, "Oh, geez, that doesn't cover any kind of counseling." And another one, you know, I felt the world was going to hell. He said, "Well, there is a program that we have, but it's a once in a lifetime. You get one shot." And I said, "Okay, I'll take it." And this was, I think it was on a Tuesday. And he said, "You ready?" I said, no, I'll go in next week." "What are you laughing about?" I had to get the cars washed and waxed, the lawn mowed, the roses trimmed, and, you know, the folks across the street, when I was gone, they asked my ex, I said, "Why does he think he has a problem? I mean, cabinets in the garage with two coats of semi-gloss paint, nicest rose bushes in the neighborhood. I looked good on the outside." But as one speaker said, I love it, he said, "If it weren't for my skin, I'd be a puddle." You know, that's about where I was. And I really hated that guy in the mirror. I was so full of shame and guilt for my behavior. But I never figured out what the problem was. Well, I checked into a nut house. Now, I love telling this, and Tommy knows it. It said Life Plus Treatment Center on the outside of the building. But the second day I was there, they gave me this tiny little booklet entitled "The Legal Rights of the Mentally Ill," just in case I had any questions. And, you know, it was a 30-day program, and the doors were never locked, and I never wanted to leave. As a matter of fact, at the end of the 30 days, I wanted to reenlist. They said, "No, sorry, guy, you know, it's easy to stay sober here. Where you need to go is out there. That's where you're going to find out if you can stay sober or not." I said, "Okay." But they told me a bunch of profound stuff at this place. They said things like, "You know, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk." I had never considered that. You know? They also told me that I wasn't a bad person, I just did bad things. And I had to have somebody go with me to my first AA meeting. I was too scared to go there alone. But once I went in that door and I found out what was going on, I didn't care if anybody went with me, you know. Because the one thing I forgot to tell you, in that nut house, I did my first fifth step. There were 17 people in that room. I didn't care who heard what. I had to get rid of it. It was killing me. They told me, "You're as sick as your secrets, and your secrets will kill you." Bad enough, I had a life and death disease. I was convinced I had a life and death disease. So, anyway, there were angels in that treatment center. Angels. Angels, I'm sure, that brought me into the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a men's meeting 100 guys on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. How do you get up at 8 o'clock on a Saturday? You can't if you've been drinking, all right? Let's just leave it at that. And like I said, I was convinced I had a life and death disease. And there was one guy there. His laugh was so obnoxious. I heard it across the room. I was thinking, what the hell's so funny? This is life and death. So I asked him to be my sponsor. And he helped me start the process of learning to live life like a loose garment. And he asked me one time, he says, what do you think your worst character defect is? I said, projection. He said, okay, let's work on that. I hate to inform you, but 35 years later, I'm still working on it. You know? I think the hardest thing I've ever found in AA is staying right here, right now, that's all. Right in the moment. You know, not worrying about yesterday or something I said or what am I going to do tomorrow. Yes, I plan the days ahead, but I try not to dwell on them. So, I forgot to tell you, I've never had a DUI. I've never lost a job because of my drinking. I never got a divorce because of my drinking. I had to get sober to take care of that one, but I drank for the effect produced by alcohol. It's that simple. You know? But something happened to me. Something happened to me. I mean, I was the National Guard, and I was drinking 6-pack a day. By the end of a 2-week summer camp, I was doing a case a day, no problem. Easy. Got to the point where alcohol, which was not my solution, I've heard that a lot in meetings, alcohol was the relief from the shame and the guilt. I drank myself sober. That was one of the scariest places I've ever been. You know, here I am looking for that relief. I just want to escape. I don't like what, you know, I've done with my life, how I'm feeling. I want to escape. And it didn't work. Didn't work. So that's why I figured I had to get treatment or something. Well, then the company asked me if I wanted to go to Georgia. I didn't say no. I said, hell no. And that was probably the smartest thing my ex-wife ever said to me. I went home that night. She says, well, you might want to say yes now. You can change your mind later. I said, oh, you're right. I went in the next day pounding on desk. I want to go to Georgia. I want to go to Georgia. And I had gone back and forth for work to the company here, same company. And I'd get back there to left coast, and they say, well, what's it like there in Georgia where everybody talks funny? I said, you know, when I'm in Georgia, I'm the one that's talking funny. You know, those people are not. But the language of AA is the same. It scared me at first because I don't know how familiar you are with the LA area, but just north of the basin is the San Fernando Valley, which has about 1.8 million people. The meeting directory for that valley alone was bigger than all of Atlanta when I moved here. I'm going, how in the hell am I going to stay sober? So, okay, two guys are in a bar and they're talking. And the subject gets around to God, you know? And the second guy says, no, I don't believe in God. I was out there lost in the wilderness and praying and nothing happened. And the first guy says, well, surely you must believe because you're here. He said, no, some damn Eskimo came. I've had a lot of Eskimos in my life. I think the first one was that nasty sponsor with the loud laugh. And every time I'd go to him with some big issue, he'd say, what can you do about it right now? And nothing. When I moved here, I was afraid. Like I said, there weren't enough AA meetings or enough recovery that saved me. So I grabbed this guy. Buckwheat was his name. That's what he went by. This guy was about 6 foot something. He was a Paulding County born raised. And he wore coveralls all the time. And one leg was shorter than the other because he'd had a bad car wreck and killed some people. And he dedicated the rest of his life to sobriety. He had 49 years when he passed away, but he had 19 at the time I asked him to be my sponsor. I figured, well, I know there's no guarantee that the guy's going to be sober when I call him, but with 19 years, pretty good chance. And one day he says to me, you know, if you want to drink, you can call me 24/7, anytime. But if you want to talk about feelings, right then I knew I was going to have to get a different sponsor. But he's the one that said, I want you to go over here to Ridgeview. You know, go on a Thursday night and meet this guy, Sam Anders. I don't know if Sam Anders was just an Eskimo or if he was an angel with skin on him. But we'd go there, we'd meet in his office, throw a bunch of barbs around. He'd give us tickets. We'd go to the cafeteria. We'd go to an aftercare meeting, and then we could take a meeting into one of the cottages. And he stuck me in Cottage C. And well, the first time I went in there, no, there's no doorknobs on the inside, okay? But I didn't know if they wanted to keep me or what the hell they were doing. That was a good group, but there's this one guy, Eddie. He, not our Eddie, different Eddie. Were you in Cottage C? Oh, no.
About 10 years later.
Yeah. Now, anyway, he just took a liking to me, right? Thought, great. The next week, I went there. It was only me and Eddie in that room with no doorknobs. I'm wondering, who's the crazy one here? But he took a liking to me. And, you know, that's what I love about this program. I don't have to be smart enough to say anything. I just have to listen and pick up what everybody else is sharing. You know? It's all I have to do is look back at my track record and know that, you know, I'm really not doing too well on my own. And that one sponsor told me the most important word in our 164 pages, this life-saving program, that's not a lot of pages. But he said the most important word is the first word of the first step. We. And if I ever lose sight of that, I'm lost. And I've come to believe that the most important thing for me to do to stay sober is to stay connected. Stay connected in this program, the alcoholics. Another Eskimo or angel was Julio Taraga. Little Julio. He'd been here like 35, 40 years from Guatemala, and he still had the accent. So we loved giving him the promises. We loved to hear the way he said the promises, right? Remember? It was wonderful. But he would bring the good and the bad to meetings. You know, saw this grown man crying in meetings and also sharing the joy in his life. I think it was his leg that he broke one time. We took a meeting to his house. And I mean, he was grateful for that. But after that, when he came to the meeting, when he shared about it, he started crying. Just that grateful for how much people cared for him, you know? And that care and support is there for anybody that wants it and is willing to do the work. See, they told me to be an old timer, all you have to do is don't drink and don't die. That's not quite true. I have to keep doing the things that I was doing the day I walked in here, you know? And they're really not that difficult things to do. Another Eskimo is Norris. Passed away not long ago, and he's a guy that he always had a pleasant demeanor, even when he was doing dialysis. And, you know, in fact, they offered him a kidney, and he said no. Or was it a liver? Either way, they offered him an organ transplant. And he said, no, I've lived a long, good life. Give it to some young person that can use it. You know? I don't know if I could be that giving. But, because I'm just like the book says. This book has me nailed. Selfish and self-centered. There's two sentences that are my favorite that I love to hate. And that's selfishness, self-centeredness. We think that is the root of our problems. And the other comes out of the 12 and 12, which I think I cherish it more than I do the big book because it breaks it down for me. It's a spiritual axiom that whenever I'm upset, no matter what the cause, can't blame it on nobody. There's something wrong with me. And it took me a while, many multiples thereof, but just two pages after that in the 12 and 12, it's in step 10, it says, finally, we begin to see that all people, including ourselves, are to some extent emotionally ill as well as frequently wrong. And then we approach true tolerance and see what real love for our fellows actually means. It will become more and more evident as we go forward that it's pointless to become angry or to get hurt by people who, like us, are suffering from the pains of growing up. You know? That's what I had to do in here, is to grow up. I had to learn responsibility. My sponsor said, you start a meeting on time and you end a meeting on time because you don't know anything about responsibility. And remember, I told you about the rose bushes. I thought I knew responsibility. I don't know. I wish I could just tell you what kind of gifts this program has given me. I'm on wife number three. Of course, she's on husband number three also. Okay, it's an even thing. Don't get anything and you're going in your head. And it was a blind date. Who is blind? She told me she went into work the next day and all the ladies asked her, well, how'd your date go? She said, no way in hell. So last November, I thanked her for 22 years of no way in hell. But it takes work. And she's a member of Al-Anon family groups, you know? Yeah, when I was out there running, I taste tested everything they had that I could get my hands on. And then I get sober, and what happens? They come up with, is it Zima? Or, I go, man, what did I miss? It's alcohol, you know, little twist on it. And now, because I do shop for my Al-Anon, she can drink, and she doesn't have a problem. She can actually put a funnel back on a wine bottle and pour it back in there. She doesn't finish it. There's something wrong with that, isn't there? You're supposed to just take the damn top off and drink the shit. That's sick. That is alcohol abuse. But I've gone in at Total Wine, and I can't believe how many flavors of vodka they have. Why? Why? There's no purpose in that. Nobody likes the taste of alcohol. You know? They say the same man will drink again. And I can tell you, not only has this lady never seen me drink, I am not the same man that arrived at AA. Not at all. And you know, if they told me, all you have to change is everything, I would have said, ain't gonna happen. Ain't gonna happen. But one day at a time, or you guys that are really brand new, 5 minutes at a time? Okay. Let's be real. You know? He told me that God will never give me more than what I can handle. Well, that's a bunch of BS, too. God will not give me more than what we can handle. That's how I've made it through these things. The darker and tougher things get, the more I dig in. They told me, you share the pain, you cut it in half. That's been my experience. And what takes more alcoholics out, I heard, and what scares me is the fear of impending good. When life gets so good that I don't have to go to a meeting. Yeah? It really wasn't that bad, was it? Let me just try some experimental drinking. I don't want to take that chance because I've seen enough of the people that are lucky enough to come back in the rooms. I'm waiting for one of them to say, you know, it was better out there. I've got, well, I don't have money, I'm married, but I have a credit card. I'm buying. I think my money's safe, you know. There's one guy, I can't remember his name, Tom, but his wife, he had 5 years in the program. His wife had just had their second child, and he was coming home alone from his parents in Asheville at a high rate of speed, and he went off the road into a junkyard and killed himself. And the good news is if he'd gone off the other side of the road, he would have gone into a mobile home park and maybe taken somebody else with him. And boy, that twisted me out because I really liked the guy. He had a strong program, I thought. I went to my sponsor. He said, Mike, you're just describing the disease of alcoholism. None of this makes sense, guys. None of this makes sense. I don't know why the program works. It's so simple, you know. My first sponsor said, now count to 10 before you. I thought, man, that's childish. Try it. I never had to go all the way to 10 before I realized that would not be a God thought, you know. To get to the point where a selfish, self-centered person like me can occasionally think about somebody else first. That's a tall order. That's a tall order. In fact, this guy was a counselor in a treatment center, and he came in all spun out one day. This is my first year of sobriety, and going ranting. Well, I went up to him afterwards, and I thanked him. I thanked him for showing me it's okay to be human, right? He said, Mike, you know what the difference is between somebody with 10 years and 10 days of sobriety? I said, oh, great guru, lay it on me. He said, well, with 10 years, occasionally I think about what I'm going to say before I say it so I don't have to make amends. I go, oh, is that as good as it gets? Some days it is. Some days it is. But I remember I was living out in Powder Springs with the ex and going to work one morning. It was about 6 in the morning, and I got to the intersection at Powder Springs Road and East Callaway at a red light and just started crying. Because I realized for the first time in my life, I hadn't woke up angry. I had 2.5, 3 years of sobriety. For the first time, I did not wake up angry. Angry with the world. You know? I still get excited. Trust me, I don't work anywhere near a perfect program. But I keep going to these guys in my home group. I have the same home group since the early 90s when I moved here. Sons of Serenity. And those guys have not only put up with me, they've guided me. They showed me how they get through stuff, you know? Oh, I can't leave out another Eskimo, Big Chuck. Chuck Moon was a Methodist minister here. In fact, we were members of his church for a while. But during wife number two, going to a couples group, and she just came at me like, and my response was, I just have to do anything that I need to do to stay sober. And this young lady here realizes that She has to be number two or she wouldn't exist. You know, my sobriety has to be first. But Chuck asked me to be his sponsor. I said, Chuck, we had about the same amount of time. He just looked at me and says, I couldn't do what you just did. Sit there and take it. And the most amazing thing that came out of our relationship there, is he told me, he says, you know, I studied God. He studied the Bible, you know. He knew it inside and out. He said, but I'm having trouble getting to know God. It's a big difference, you know. I came in believing that when you're holding hands with me, I know where the lightning bolt's going to hit. You better let go, you know. But the first time I saw that poem, Footprints, I knew why I was still here. You see, 16 years on the left coast, the only thing I owned was a motorcycle. And I remember going in and out of blackouts over 100 miles an hour, throwing my motorcycle at cars. This one poor old guy, he was just coming home from work one night. Nobody else on the interstate. And he changed lanes without using a signal. I was going to fix that. So I just scared the shit out of him. I told my sponsor, I said, how can I ever make amends to somebody like that? I don't know him. He said, be kind to old people. You know, there is a way. There is a way to make amends. My dad passed away when I was 16. And, man, there were many times. There's still times when I wish he was around to slap me upside the head and say, pay attention, or good job, you know. My cousin took me to his grave in Chicago one time and left me alone there. I made my amends. And I felt a presence telling me it was going to be all right. So, don't tell me there's no God. But I got to know a God that's caring and loving through you people. I learned love in this program. I just want to read one quick little thing to close. Because my job was just to touch one person tonight. And I hope he's here, or she. This is from the foreword in this, and it's read at my Saturday morning meeting. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. I become happily and usefully whole thanks to you guys. Thanks.
I appreciate that, Mike. Thank you much. He just said, we'll get even. He didn't come here like 100% ready to do his story. He's like, I don't want to do that, but I was told never to say no. So he went ahead and said yes. And so anyway, now it looks like I'm going to owe him one.